So, what we're doing today? Today we're having a lecture on strategic commitment. I've heard from my tutors that people were having difficulties with solving some of the tutorial questions. There was a tutorial question. One particular tutorial question was about the Stackelberg model, the first mover advantage. That's okay, because actually this is the material that we're going to learn during this lecture. As I mentioned in the beginning of the course, not all tutorial questions are meant to be covered during the tutorials themselves. Some questions in the tutorials are for your own practice, and as such, do not always have to chronologically coincide with the past lectures, if you know what I mean. So no stress, take it easy, and yet don't take it easy. Do try to solve questions both covered in tutorials and not covered in tutorials. The questions not covered in tutorials are there for your benefit as additional practice. We would have less of a hard time preparing tutorials with fewer questions and having to solve fewer problems. But we have quite a lot of questions in the bank. This course has been taught for a number of years, and so we have the luxury of having lots of questions to, you know, offer to you or to offer for your practice. So that's one announcement I have to make. The other announcements I have to make is, well, the second announcement I have to make is the announcement that we are currently thinking about changing the way we teach tutorials. To be more precise, we are thinking of reducing the number of tutorials, because experience shows that some tutorials scheduled at 8 in the morning on Friday are not very well attended. So, surprise, surprise. So what we're thinking of doing, my tutors and I can't confirm it yet, but that's an idea that we're working on. What we're thinking of doing is reducing the number of tutorials, and instead of teaching tutorials on Friday mornings when no one comes, we'll do a help desk. We'll do a help desk. What it means is that people can come in regular times, so basically the schedule remains the same, except that some of the slots that are meant to be for tutorials will now be help desk slots. What it means is that you come to these slots, you come to these dates, and you can have a one-to-one consultation with a tutor. So if you've been trying to solve tutorial questions, if you've been practicing for the course and are having some difficulty solving the questions, we need some information, need some hints about how to deal with the course problems, the tutors will be there for you. So that's the format, that's the change that we're currently thinking. We have to solve a few administrative difficulties, but I am optimistic and hopeful that we can introduce this, and I think there will be more benefit than costs of this arrangement. And it goes without saying that, as I always told you, I am there for you. You're welcome to come to my office to ask me questions, to contact me if you have difficulties with the course. I do like to hear your feedback. So far, no one has really contacted me about the course. That's not good, because we are sort of well in the middle of the semester, well, approaching the middle of the semester. People should have some questions already. Do not delay preparation for the exam. Be regular, review things after each lecture, try to solve as many questions as you can. This is the best way to prepare for the exam. It's a difficult course. I just don't want to have too many disappointed students. I don't want to deal with too many students taking this course too many times, if you know what I mean. So, and the best way to do this is to stay tuned and use all the resources that my tutors and I are offering. Now, the third and final announcement I have to make is that there will be no lecture next week. I've already made this announcement in the past, but just to make sure everybody hears it, once again, there will be no lecture next week, okay? So the next lecture will happen in 1 week's time. Next week I'll be visiting a conference in Washington where I will be presenting my research on the effectiveness of incentive pay depending on local competition. A very, very organizational economics inspired theme. So if you're interested, I could give you a little presentation later on. But not today. The topic today is strategic commitment. What is strategic commitment? Let me start with a couple of examples. One is really old example, but it's a classical example. Many textbooks that teach strategic commitment, many courses that teach strategic commitment are talking about this example. So let's go back to Stone Age. Let's go back to late 70s, early 80s. In late 70s, early 80s, people used very strange devices to listen to music. So they didn't have iPads or whatever these gadgets are called these days. So they used vinyl discs and they used tapes to record and play out music. And they used these big wooden boxes called stereo or audio players to reproduce music. And there was a market for LPs, for the vinyl discs, which is now experiencing a revival, but it was almost killed a decade ago. There were tapes, tape cassettes, the big tape cassettes, the small tape cassettes, and there was a very cool new thing, very new technology called compact disc or CD. Right? So back in those days, no one really heard about compact discs all that much. And here's a very big, large, famous electronics firm called Philips. Everybody knows what Philips is. It has evolved since electronics more into healthcare products these days. But back then, it produced cool video or audio recorders. And it also produced the medium for recording music, the tapes, the LPs, and you know it got on with this new thing called compact discs. It was a very nascent market with huge potential, but also huge risks. And not only Philips, but a couple of other firms took interest in developing the compact disc technology to make it commercially viable enough to replace tape cassettes, for instance, which are not really a very efficient or practical way of recording and reproducing music. And of course, it's a new market, huge potential. A few other firms are willing to participate. So we are having a Cournot-type competition on the CD market between Philips and its competitors. And as a result, you have lots of firms producing collectively too much stuff as compared to the monopoly profit-maximizing quantity. Therefore, the market price is less than the profit-maximizing monopoly price. How can firms try to increase their profit in the Cournot or Bertrand competition? One way to do so that we studied last lecture was, you want to try to collude with your competitors. And if your competitors are reasonable people, and if the future is certain enough, so your R is small enough, that's the last lecture, then the collusion will become self-sustainable in the sense that you don't actually have to physically shake hands. There will be a robust enough system of understandings that will develop and will increase your profits, will bring your profits close to the monopoly level, even though formally you are competing with the other guys. But because the competition is repeated interaction and you do tit for tat or even grim trigger, the equilibrium outcome in the repeated interaction is closer or even at the monopoly level as compared to the competition level of output and price in the one-off interaction. So that's one way of doing it. But as we learned last week,
collusion
is not always sustainable. You need to have certain enough future, small enough R. You need to have a certain number of competitors. You need to have a certain distribution of competitors. So not too small guys, not too big guys. You need to have a quite well established system to detect deviation, right? So you need the speed of reaction to be quite fast. So not all of these ingredients to establish sustainable collusion were there back in the early 80s on these nascent CD markets. There were small firms, there were big firms, there were small subsidies of big firms, there were big firms committing themselves to the market to a fuller extent. The future was too uncertain because the CD technology was still in its early days, and so the R's that firms used in their calculations were perhaps too large to enable collusion. So collusion didn't work. Firms competed like hell. What else can you do? That's what Philips did. Philips made an announcement in 1982 that it was building a huge factory in the United States, which was designed solely and only for producing compact discs. So this bunch of machines, this big building, logistics, the trucks, the people, everything, all the production process was there to produce compact discs, nothing else. And it made this announcement, and this factory cost, I think, $1.5 billion in the prices of those days, which is quite a lot of money. So they made this announcement. What happened is that the other guys, the other firms that were trying to compete on this new market for compact discs with Philips, withdrew. And for a long time, actually for quite a long time, Philips remained the leader on the very lucrative and eventually very large market for producing CDs. CD has become the major carrier of music until quite recently, where now most of the music is carried in the cloud or whatever, so the physical carriers are not that important. But for quite a long time, for a couple of decades, CD was really the medium of choice for recording and playing music, and Philips has made a lot of money. And strategic management experts really like this case, because what it demonstrates is the benefits of strategic commitment. So what is strategic commitment? You know the word commitment, right? So the word commitment, when you commit yourself to a certain action and you cannot withdraw from this commitment, right? So there is quite a big difference between cheap talk and commitment. If you say that, oh, I'm going to build this huge, large factory producing CDs so that I will flood the market with lots of CDs so that the price will be so low that you small guys are not going to make profit on this market, so don't even try to enter this market, it's mine. That's cheap talk, right? Because when the push comes to the shove, as it were, the firm will find it optimal for themselves to not put their money where their mouth is. So cheap talk is not working, right? And we've seen already in the market entry game, when we studied game theory, that cheap talk doesn't work. If firms promise to behave aggressively, they will not find it optimal to behave aggressively when the new competitors enter the market. Commitment, especially strategic, so commitment is a world of difference away from cheap talk. Because when you do commitment, you actually do something. You not only talk, you actually do something. So you spend money and you make it known that you spend money on a technology that you cannot use in any other way other than producing this particular product. And people can estimate the capacity that you will be able to produce, the amount of output that you'll be able to supply to the market, and they will do their calculations and they will say, we're not going to break even, so we won't even try entering the market. Right? So the difference, so this case illustrates the difference between commitment and cheap talk. Cheap talk, when you just threaten but you don't do anything, and most importantly, you will not do anything when you can do something because it's not profitable for you. Commitment, Commitment is not cheap talk, because when you commit yourself to something, you actually do it. And you cannot withdraw this commitment. You cannot withdraw this commitment very easily. You couldn't sell this factory for anything close to the price at which you built it, because it's single use, because for a variety of reasons. So you basically sunk a lot of money into it, which means that you mean it when you say that I will expand output, which means that if you find yourself in a Cournot competition, the best reaction of the competitors will be to withdraw, will be to reduce their output. Remember the reaction function in the Cournot model. But if they have to withdraw their output, then in the presence of fixed costs and other barriers to entry, many of them will find it not profitable entering the market at all. So one way for the firm to cement its monopolistic position on the market is to commit itself to a major capacity increase. Well, this is a very old example. Here's a new example. Another example of strategic commitment. This is a much more recent example. I'm sure it will eventually make its way to strategy textbooks. But very recently, I read Handelsblatt, and I read in Handelsblatt that Volkswagen has committed itself, right? It's committed itself to invest 75 billion euros over the next 5 years to establish technology and facilities and the whole infrastructure, logistics, HR, finance, everything you need to produce electric cars. Volkswagen, this scandalous firm that fine-tuned its software to detect when to detect being tested, so as to fit the diesel emissions on paper, right? So it was a huge scandal, and Volkswagen has lost a lot of money in the aftermath. So here comes Volkswagen, investing lots and lots of money into a technology which is not diesel, is not petrol. It's a very, very new technology. It's electric cars, and it's what Volkswagen is yet not really very well known for. So what is the biggest player in the electric cars market right now? It's Tesla. And the second biggest player is Toyota, right? And there is a bunch of other guys. Where is Volkswagen on the electric cars market? Nowhere. And here comes Volkswagen and says, guys, don't even think about entering the German market, because I'm gonna produce so many electric Volkswagens in the next 5 years. Look, I'm investing 72 billion euros that you won't make any reasonable profit. And look how many Teslas are now traveling on German roads. I see more and more of them. So does Volkswagen. Sees more and more Teslas and Toyotas traveling on German roads. They've got to do something. They've got to do something about it. So one thing they could do is to say, in a manner of cheap talk, that, oh, guys, we're going to compete with Tesla. We are the major German car producer. Of course, we're going to flood the market with lots of electric cars, which we'll be able to sell cheaper. That's cheap talk, because you don't have the infrastructure to do this. Car production is not bio croissants or mineral water, and the examples we used before. Even if you want to produce croissants, you need to have the capacity. For cars, you need to build the capacity over the course of maybe years before you can start producing things. So you have to commit yourself to a certain course of action in order for the competitors to register that you mean business and reassess their competitive strategy with regards to German or maybe EU-wide market, right? So, of course, it's not yet clear whether it will be successful or not. We know for a fact that Philips' strategic commitment move in 1982 was very successful. With the benefit of hindsight, we can see it. We don't know how successful Volkswagen will be, but it's certainly a very, very strong commitment to a technology that will shape the future of the car industry. And Volkswagen wants to be part of this future. Not only wants to be part of this future, it wants actually to be the leader in the future as well. And in order to maintain or even strengthen its competitive position on the market, what it does is it does strategic commitment. It doesn't do collusion, right? It doesn't do market. It doesn't do this aggressive market behavior games. It doesn't threaten with aggressive behavior. It does strategic commitment. So in this lecture, we're going to study why strategic commitment works. Why strategic commitment works? Why does it help? Why, how, and when does strategic commitment help maintain and even strengthen the competitive position of firms on the market? So we will consider strategic commitment, as has been the tradition in this course, we will consider strategic commitment in the Cournot framework when competition happens with quantities, in the Bertrand framework when competition is in terms of prices. We will learn about firms' best strategies in Cournot versus Bertrand competition. We basically already know from the game theory lecture that Cournot strategies are strategic substitutes in the sense that if one competitor increases output, the other should withdraw. Bertrand strategies are strategic complements in the sense that if one guy increases prices, your best response is also to increase the price. And if the other guy reduces the prices, your best response is also to reduce the price. So today we're going to revisit these positions see what it means in terms of strategic commitment. That's basically an agenda. That's basically an agenda. So notion of strategic commitment, a few games, strategic commitment in Cournot, strategic commitment in Bertrand, and what are the best strategies in Cournot versus Bertrand competition. Okay, now, let's now move from anecdotes, from business case studies, let's move into more rigorous, more theoretical study of strategic commitment. And what can be more rigorous and theoretical as studying strategic commitment with the help of a game, right? So here's a game. And it's a simultaneous game to keep things simple. So we're not talking about collusion here. Collusion obviously happens when this interaction is repeated. So these are the firm 1 and firm 2. Think about it as Volkswagen and Tesla. And they decide how many electric cars to produce, right? So they can produce few cars or they can produce many cars. And these are the profits of firms 1 and 2. Depending on how many cars they will produce and how many cars their competitor will produce, right? So if both produce low number of cars, if both produce low capacity, right, then there isn't a lot of stuff on the market. There aren't a lot of electric cars on the market. That's why they're so expensive. So everybody will make a lot of profit, but this is not an equilibrium, obviously, because why it's not an equilibrium? Because the other guy, namely firm 2, has an incentive to deviate from it. Because if firm 1 stays low, if firm 2 increases its capacity, it will make a profit of 4. Never mind that the other guy is going to lose. They don't care. So equally here, if they both dump the market with electric cars, then there will be so many electric cars they will sell at the price of Toyota or even worse, an Opel, and the prices are going to go down, the profits are going to go down as well. Okay, so and that's not an equilibrium again because both firms will have an incentive to deviate from it. So let's use our good old game theory solving technique to determine the Nash equilibrium here. We will choose the best reaction of each firm and highlight it in bold. So if firm 2 does low, the best thing for firm 1 to do is to do low. That's why this is highlighted in bold. If firm 1 does high, the best thing for firm 2 to do is to do low. That's why 2 is highlighted in bold. You get me. So, and the cell in which the best reactions of the two firms will correspond is the cell that gives us the Nash equilibrium. And the Nash equilibrium in this game is Volkswagen produces few electric cars, Tesla produces lots of electric cars. So Volkswagen, of course, doesn't like it, but that's an equilibrium. So you have the market leader, which is firm 1, Sorry, firm two. Firm two, of course. Firm two. And you have the little guy who is trailing behind, the follower, right? So firm one is the follower, firm one isn't making a lot of money, firm two is bathing in money. What can firm one do in order to improve its fortunes a bit? What can firm one do? In this game, nothing. This is an equilibrium, right? Whatever it does, it's going to do worse than in the equilibrium. That's why it's an equilibrium, right? So, however, let us introduce the possibility to commit to a certain action. Let us introduce the possibility for firm one to commit to producing high capacity. So firm one is Volkswagen in our example. Let's give it 72 billion euros and push them to the frontal stage, push them to the television and say, guys, here's 72 billion euros. We're increasing capacity. We're building new plants, new facilities. We're converting our existing plants to produce electric cars, so that in the next 5 years, 25% of the cars we produce will be electric cars. Everybody will say, wow. Okay, so what happens if firm one commits to high capacity? Well, if firm one commits to high capacity, then this strategy is no longer relevant, because firm one is not going to produce low. Firm one has eliminated this completely. So the only thing firm one is going to do is high, right? It will not have, it's not going to chicken out and switch to low, which the existing Nash equilibrium requires. Now, if firm one produces high, what is the best thing for firm two to do? What is the best thing for firm two to do? The best thing for firm two to do is to produce low. That's the best thing for firm two to do. Right, it's not going to make lots of money from producing high either. I mean, if both firms producing high, they're going to lose money. But the trick is that if firm one already establishes itself on the market by committing to high capacity, the best thing firm two can do is to withdraw from the market, produce low. What will happen as a result? Well, as a result, the fortune will change quite drastically. Now, it is firm one that is the market leader, earning the profit of 3 billion euros, and firm two is trailing behind with the profit of 2 billion euros, which is half of the profit and size that it used to have before firm one committed itself to high capacity. So this is an illustration of what happens, of the good thing that's going to happen when one of the competitors strategically commits to producing high capacity on the market, right? So, this slide summarizes the results. Where do we take our discussion from now? Timing matters. Timing matters. The game that we have discussed is a one-shot game, that's true. However, it matters who commits first. It matters who commits first. That's why timing matters. Let me explain precisely what I mean. Suppose firm two commits first to high capacity. Suppose it's firm two, the Tesla, that says, I have 200 billion euros to flood the world with electric cars, you know? So if firm two commits to high capacity first, and firm one has to react, the best thing that firm one can do is to produce low, and we're back to the existing Nash equilibrium as we know it. So no effect. If firm two commits first, it's only if firm one commits first that we're going to have a switch from this equilibrium to this equilibrium, which is better for firm one that commits first. Now, of course, a disaster can happen if both firms commit simultaneously. If both firms commit simultaneously, then what you're going to see is really lousy equilibrium in which both firms are making not so much money, right? So That's why timing matters. It's of crucial importance who commits first, right? And you have to commit first. If you because strategic commitment only works if your action makes the other guy react to your action. So when you do strategic commitment, you have to make the other guys react to you rather than you reacting to the other guys. And that leads us to the notion of the first mover advantage. I don't know if you've heard about this notion. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. It's a very interesting notion in strategic management. First mover advantage. Being first in committing yourself to a certain course of action is advantageous, is good for you. And so first mover advantage is important. So not only should you do strategic commitment, you should do it in the right way, and you should be first. Now, what is the second ingredient in the success of strategic commitment as a strategic management practice? Well, strategic commitment, as we learned in the beginning of the lecture, strategic commitment has to be different from cheap talk, right? You can pretend to commit to a certain course of action, but unless you make a costly commitment, it's cheap talk, right? So if you are proposing to your loved one, you have to give them a ring. If you don't give them a ring, it's cheap talk, right? So you have to somehow commit yourself. Commitment has to be credible. Credible, right? So people have to believe that you mean what you say. And the best way to make people believe that you mean what you say is to throw money at it. So throwing money at things when you make strategic commitment, buying this useless engagement ring... All jewelry is useless, really, but people spend lots of money on it. I mean, do you eat it? But it plays a role. It plays a role because it's observable, it's credible, and it's coherent. It's consistent with what you want to achieve on the market. So credibility can be achieved if the commitment is very costly or impossible to reverse. Once you bought that engagement ring, it's useless. You can't present it to another person, can you? So maybe you can, but then I wouldn't shake your hand. The commitment has to be observable. Everybody has to see it, and it has to be coherent. Now, so you're going to make it either very costly or impossible to reverse, or you could sign a contract. That's another way. Now, contracts are typically limited. You can't contract everything in your life, so the option of the contract may or may not be there, but the universal way to make commitment credible is to throw money at it. Now, let us look at the theory called Stackelberg model, which explains why strategic commitment is such a good thing, especially when it's done by the first mover. So, what impact does sequential decisions have? Do sequential decisions have in a Cournot competition? So that leads us to the notion of the first mover advantage. Let's consider the following game, and it's a Cournot competition. We can write the same game in Bertrand competition. That's not going to be very, very difficult. So here's our Cournot competition, and our good friends Alnatura and Basic producing croissants, I think. I don't remember anymore. So it doesn't matter. Here's the demand equation. You've seen it already. Here's the cost equations. You've seen it already. What we know about these guys is that when there is Cournot competition, they simultaneously choose quantity because it's Cournot. They simultaneously choose QA and QB, and the QA and QB are together larger than the profit-maximizing monopoly output. Alnatura and Basic can, of course, collude. That's the last lecture, but that's not what we're considering now. Suppose collusion is impossible. Suppose they will compete like hell. Until firm A chooses its quantity first and makes its choice known to firm B, right? So it's not exactly simultaneous. You know, you are 5 seconds first. You know, you let the market know before firm B the capacity that you have chosen. So let A choose its quantity first, and then B will choose its own quantity. Now, the key thing here is that firm B will choose its quantity in reaction to the choice that firm A has made already. And that creates a world of difference. So let's see how it works mathematically. Let's start with firm B, right? So firm B chooses its quantity, QB, from the following profit function. It maximizes its profit function given the choice of firm A, right? And when you take the first order condition of this function with respect to QB and solve it in terms of QA, you will get the following expression. This is the reaction function of firm B in response to firm A. So the more output firm A produces, the less output firm B will optimally choose to produce. Okay? So far, so good. Nothing new yet, right? It's the typical reaction function of firm B in response to firm A that we've studied already. The new thing is really here. This is the new thing. So by assumption, we assumed in the beginning, right? We assumed that firm A makes the first move. Okay? Now, and firm A is not only quick, it's also intelligent and fully rational, as Mr. Nash would assume, right? So, firm A anticipates the reaction function of firm B to its quantity choice, and let's see what happens to the profit function of firm A. Let's just see what happens. So, here's profit function of firm A. It depends on its own quantity choice. It depends on the quantity choice of QB, right? The magic that happens now is that now firm A knows the quantity that firm B will choose in response to its quantity choice. How does it know it? It knows it from firm B's reaction function. So you take QB from the reaction function and substitute it here. And what you get as a result is the profit function of firm A, which now contains not the quantity of firm B, but the reaction function of firm B, which tells you how much quantity firm B will choose in response to the choice QA of firm A that happens first. Do you understand? Very easy, isn't it? Right? So here's your profit function. You maximize it the usual way, first order condition. And what you get is that the quantity that firm A will optimally choose, being the first mover, is 45, because it maximizes the profit function of firm A. Okay, how much will firm B choose? Well, firm B will choose the amount of quantity that comes from firm B's reaction function. So substitute QA equal 45 in here, do the calculation, and get the best quantity choice by firm B, 22.5 units. Wow. There's a world of change. What has changed? Recall that when firms choose their quantities simultaneously, so nobody makes the first mover, nobody commits themselves strategically to a certain amount of output, the simultaneous quantity choice is 30 each. So both will produce 30 units of output. And given this Nash equilibrium quantity, the Nash equilibrium profit is going to be 900 per firm, right? What happens when firm A has the first mover advantage? Firm A chooses not 30, but 45. 45, right? Chooses 45. Firm B, the best thing for firm B to do is not to choose 30. That would lose money for firm B. The best thing for firm B to do is to choose 22.5. And as a result, firm A makes a profit of more than 1,000, which is way higher than it used to make when things were simultaneous. And firm B makes the profit which is way lower than the profit firm B used to enjoy when things were simultaneous. Okay? So now, just to check your understanding, as a practice question, if firm A didn't have the first mover advantage, would it ever choose the quantity 45? Would it ever choose the quantity of 45? Yes and no. And if no, why not? So try yourself and see how you can answer these questions. Now, but what we see as a result, we see that first mover advantage really makes an additional 100 for firm A. Never mind that firm B loses almost 400, but no one cares because firm A only cares about its profit. Now, is strategic commitment good for society? Is strategic commitment good for us? Should we welcome big firms committing themselves to capacity increase? Is it good for us, or is it just the strategic games of the big guys trying to maximize their profit with potentially negative consequences for the society? Is it good or is it bad for the society? What do you think? Anybody? Is strategic commitment good for society or not? What do you think? You think it's bad? Because? The price is higher. The price is lower. Look, the price is lower. Look, the firm A chooses 45, the firm B chooses 22.5, the total quantity is 67.5, the price is, what, 62.5, right? But when you have simultaneous, then the total quantity is 60 and the price is 40. So it's good for society. Because you get more stuff sold at lower price. Right? So first mover advantage is good. Now, so that's really the only thing that changes as compared to the classic standard Cournot equilibrium. This is basically the essence of the Stackelberg model. Stackelberg said, okay, wait a moment. In 1934, he said, wait a moment, firms don't really... don't really always choose things completely simultaneously. You see firms making announcements. You see firms making announcements about their plans. Why do firms make announcements about their plans? They make announcements about their plans to send a signal that they're going to increase their capacity beyond Nash equilibrium in Cournot competition. And the best thing to do for other firms is to listen to this announcement and withdraw from the market. Okay. Now, so this story, which we told in terms of Cournot model, when firms compete in terms of prices, you can write down the same story when firms Cournot model, firms compete in terms of quantity. Sorry about this. You can write down a model similar to this when firms compete in terms of prices, and. You know, the only thing you need to do is to define what you mean by strategic commitment in terms of price. But maybe it's not so difficult to do. You could solve an equilibrium in which the first mover will make a profit and the second mover will make less profit. By the way, now that we talk about first mover advantage and strategic commitment in the Bertrand world... A few days ago, I've been to a big store in Zingen called Bauhaus. You know this? So I had to buy a table for my kitchen. And there I saw a notice. I saw a notice which said that if you find the same products elsewhere, bring it to us and we will refund. You know, more than 100% of the difference. So you basically get such a refund that you'll be still better off buying it from Bauhaus. So that's a commitment. It's a legal, juridical commitment on behalf of the Bauhaus to be always selling its things, no matter what, to be always selling it at a lower price. Right? So... why does Bauhaus do it? What is the strategic management reason to do this? I mean, do they have extra money to waste? I mean, at the end of the day, if you bought something at Bauhaus, and if something is cheaper in another shop, what's the big problem? I mean, yes, market is imperfect. There's competition, there's information asymmetry. Sometimes things are cheaper, other times things are more expensive. Why is Bauhaus trying to do this? Because Bauhaus is a big, major competitor on the market where volumes are so large and capacity is basically so large that the competition is largely in terms of prices. And the best thing to do in this market is to commit yourself to lower price first. And then the competitors will react to this. And the competitor reaction to this will give you the first mover advantage. We will talk more about it, so things will become a little bit more, you know, hopefully a bit more stable, a bit more clear what I mean. Right now, let's get back to the lecture slides and talk about two types of commitment. Two types of commitments. You can commit in two major ways. And the terminology is a bit strange, but you're going to have to live with it. The terminology is this. There are two types of commitment. One is called tough commitment. And the other type of commitment is called soft commitment. So what is tough commitment? Tough commitment is a commitment to aggressive action. Tough commitment is the commitment to aggressive action. What is aggressive action? What is aggressive action is determined depending on the type of competition in which you find yourself in. If it's Cournot competition, if firms compete in terms of quantities when capacity is limited, the tough commitment, the aggressive action in the Cournot world is to produce more output. Okay? What is the attack, what is the aggressive action in the Bertrand world where firms compete in terms of prices? The best action there is to reduce the price. So how can you be nasty to the other firms? You have to either increase the capacity, which will lead them to withdraw, or you could reduce your price, which will lead them to reduce their price. So that's the way for you to be nasty to the other, aggressive to your competitors on the market. That's tough commitment. Now, but there can also be soft commitment. So far we concentrated on the tough commitment, but that's not the entire story. There is soft commitment. You know, you can commit yourself to withdrawal. You can commit yourself to reduce output if it's Cournot, or you can commit yourself to higher price if it's Bertrand. People can ask me a question. You've got to be joking. Who will ever find it profitable to do soft commitment? And the answer is, it depends on the type of competition. It depends on the type of competition. In some competitive environments, tough commitment is the best thing that you should do, and you should do it if you have the first mover advantage. In other competitive environments, such as Bertrand, the best thing to do is actually soft commitment, and you should do it if you have the first mover advantage in the market where competition happens in terms of price. So, depending on the nature of competition, tough or soft commitment may be more advantageous. So, let's look at tough commitment under Cournot. What is tough commitment under Cournot? Tough commitment in the Cournot world is increasing capacity, is what Volkswagen has promised to do, right? Is what Philips did in 1982. So what happens when you make tough commitment under Cournot competition? Your reaction function moves to the right. Because whatever is the output of the other guy, your output now is higher, always. So, because you've built this factory, whatever the other guy is going to produce, your output is always going to be larger. Why? Because you've got this whole factory producing lots of CDs or electric cars. Right? So that's why tough commitment under Cournot competition shifts your reaction function to the right. What happens, this was the Nash equilibrium before you made the tough commitment. This is the Nash equilibrium after you made the tough commitment. Which one do you like better? Well, I like this one better because the firm that made tough commitment is now producing more and the firm that did not make tough commitment is now producing less. See? So firm one increases its market presence. Firm two withdraws its market presence. What it means in the Cournot world is that the firm that increases its market presence gets more profit. The firm that withdraws from the market now gets less profit. Welcome to the Cournot world. So tough commitment. Tough commitment is the strategy to follow when you believe that the competition is in terms of Cournot. Now, if you care to read the textbook, you will see even funnier terminology. The different competitive strategies are called the different funny names. I'm just giving it for completeness. Here's a table from the textbook for the first part of the course, and you will see that there are lots of funny names of competitive strategies which describe the various actions that are consistent with these strategies. But that's not, you know, I'm not going to ask you in the exam what is suicidal Siberian strategy, right? You don't need to memorize these terms. All I'm showing to you is that, you know, is that there is a lot of strategies that firms can take in various competitive environments. However, the multitude of strategies does not mean that each strategy is good. In fact, of these many strategies, only some of the strategies are optimal, and then the optimality of these strategies depends on the market in which you find yourself. So, this is as far as Cournot is concerned. So, in the Cournot, you have to do top dog, right? Which means produce lots of output. Commit yourself to producing lots of output. What happens when you do Bertrand? What happens when you find yourself competing with other firms in terms of prices? Okay. It turns out that when you compete with other firms in terms of prices, the best thing you can do is to actually commit yourself to a higher price. Commit yourself to a higher price. So say it to Bauhaus and ask them why they're doing it. Well, probably the answer from their strategic management consultants would be because we can't commit ourselves to higher price, so we can just continue competing on the market, try to win as large market share as possible to get as much custom from the buyers as possible, and that sort of helps. But from the strategic point of view, if you compete in terms of prices, the best thing for you to do is to commit somehow, we will discuss later, is to commit to higher price than the Nash equilibrium, right? If you can do it, it's very difficult. It's much harder to do for the reasons we will discuss shortly. But let's assume you can do it. Let's assume you can do it. What happens? This is the Nash equilibrium under Bertrand competition when firms choose their prices simultaneously. So you have the price of firm 1 and you have the price of firm 2. This is the Nash equilibrium, right? Okay, now, suppose that firm 1 can somehow credibly commit itself. Any questions? Right, so suppose firm 1 can credibly commit itself to increasing the price. What happens as a result? As a result, the reaction function of firm 1 moves to the right. Why does it move to the right? Because if you commit yourself to higher price, if you commit yourself to, let's say, you know, a price increase of 10%, then no matter what the price of firm 2 is, your price is always going to be 10% higher than it was before because you've committed yourself to a higher price. Okay. What happens? The new Nash equilibrium in this game is that now you'll be able to charge a higher price. And if you charge a higher price, in the Bertrand world, if you charge a higher price, you get higher profit. The problem with Bertrand competition is that firms compete like hell, and as a result, they charge very low prices. If only they could collude, they would make a lot more money. So any price increase in Bertrand competition is moving the price closer to its monopoly level, which is good for the firms, but not so good for the society. But, you know, if you can make a commitment to higher price, then the benefits you're going to reap are the higher price that you can sell, that you can charge, and higher price than that your competitor will have to charge as the best response. You know, a naive criticism of this story would be as follows. Come on, you know, if you commit yourself to higher price, the other firm will have every incentive to undermine you. The other firm will have every incentive to undercut and win lots of market and, you know, basically undercut you. Yes. So how can you have, a better Nash equilibrium with higher profits for yourself when you commit to higher price? This is a naive argument. Is a naive argument which doesn't take into account the strategicality of the responses of firms to the behaviors of their competitor. If I see that my competitor cannot charge more than what he's just said, I will take advantage of it. And the way I will take advantage of it will not be by sticking to my existing price, because yes, I will sell a lot, but I will not make as much profit per unit. The best thing I can do in the Bertrand world is to increase my price to the level corresponding to the price to which my competitor has committed himself. That's the way for me to maximize my profit. Now, as I promised, let's talk about the way in which you can commit to higher price. This, as I said, is much harder than in Cournot world. The way you can commit yourself to higher output. To higher output in Cournot world is to build a new factory. It's basically to carry out an action that has a contract. You can do it on television. You can put a big signature under the contract, shake hands, and everybody will say, oh yes, they are building a factory. Great. Now, how can you commit yourself to a higher price in a way as to make it credible, coherent, and observable, right? You know, how many announcements in the press have you seen telling that this firm has committed to selling its products at the price no lower than X? I mean, I've seen a lot more announcements in the press where firms commit themselves to price to maximum price rather than to minimum price, right? So it's very, very hard to commit to a higher price in a Bertrand competition. But let me try. If you have other ideas, please make them known to me, either right now or later by email. I will, if these ideas are good, I will incorporate them in the lectures. So here's my pitch. Organic products. No genetic modification products, which are very popular in Germany. You know, have you seen this? There's a proliferation of this biologisch, organic, no genetic modifications. Now, in my personal opinion, I'm not trying to impose it on people, even though of course I am, and it's televised. Now, in my personal opinion, it's all rubbish. It's all rubbish. Especially the genetically modified stuff. There's nothing wrong with genetically modified stuff. In fact, much of what we eat is genetically modified. Have you ever tried original apples or original bread? They don't look like garden apples or the bread that you eat, right? So a lot of things are genetically modified, and I personally see nothing wrong with genetically modified products. So, but I see that firms do this. And why? Right? So one reason could be that there are lots of people who don't really understand what genetic modification means, and they are frightened by the word genes and modified. That's also possible, right? But there's a more strategic reason. If you commit yourself, if you put a stamp on your product saying that it's biological and that's not genetically modified, or even, you know, you can even say, oh, it's fair trade, whatever it means, right? You commit yourself, that's an effective way of committing yourself to selling these price, selling these things at a price which is a little bit higher than competitors, right? You know, compare this organic, no genetically modified honey, which costs $3.50 a little jar, with the Ja honey in Rewe, which costs $1.50 a jar, right? I fail to see any difference in terms of the biology of the product. But Edeka commits itself to selling things at higher price because it's sort of into this genetically unmodified and biological things, right? Fair trade. So these things that you observe on daily basis, this market segmentation along the lines of biological, non-biological, fair trade, non-fair trade, genetically modified, not genetically modified, is one of the ways to make sense of it, is to think about this as a way for firms to try and commit themselves to selling things at a higher price, reflecting the allegedly higher costs of producing these things according to the biological, no genetically modified fair trade standards. You see what I mean? Right? So it's very hard to say, from now on, I'm going to increase my price. Because you can't write a contract or you can't build a factory that will make this commitment credible. But you can say that I am producing a better product in some sense for some people, right? And this way you will commit yourself to a justified increase in its price. And that's good because your competitors will observe you committing in effect to a higher price, and they will optimally, as Bertrand competition suggests, they will optimally respond by increasing their price. So this is the equilibrium without biological products. This is the equilibrium with biological products. If you like my story, but again, that's, you know, I can't say that this story is the only way in which firms commit to higher prices, or for that matter, I can't really say whether commitment Bertrand way is the major reason why firms engage into fair trade or biological. Maybe there are some other reasons, like, for instance, the good feeling that people get from buying fair trade and they're willing to pay for it, or beliefs which are important, which shape consumer choices, etc., etc. So I'm not denying these stories. What I'm saying is that, in my opinion, there's one element there what has to do more with strategic management rather than the alleged dangers of genetically modified things, which don't exist. I haven't seen a single study showing that genetically modified things are bad for your health. Right. So, where are we? Taxonomy of the firm's strategy. So, what we've learned so far can be effectively summarized with the following table, right? So, depending on whether you are in the Bertrand world or in the Cournot world, depending on whether you compete in prices with lots and lots of quantity potentially available for sale, or whether you compete in quantity when quantity is a limitation, when you have to first spend time creating products before selling it, depending on the type of the competition, tough or soft commitment may be the best strategy. The tough commitment is the commitment to behaving aggressively, and that means increasing output and reducing price. Right? So we've seen that tough commitment is the best strategy when competition is Cournot. Why? Because when competition is Cournot, the aggressive tough commitment to increasing capacity leads to a new equilibrium which increases the output for the firm that has made this commitment, which means higher profit for the firm that has made this commitment. So that's what makes tough commitment under Cournot competition the best strategy. Okay, this is the top dog strategy, if you like. Now, can you do aggressive commitment in the Bertrand world? Yes, you can. Sure, you can. You can commit yourself to lower price. That's easy to do. But that's not the best strategy you can do. That's not the best strategy you can follow. Why not? Because if you do it in the Bertrand world, the tough commitment in the Bertrand world will shift your reaction curve to the left. And so in the new equilibrium, you'll be charging even lower price than you used to charge, because your competitors will have no choice but to respond to this. But that's not the best thing for you to do. The best thing for you to do, if you're competing in the Bertrand world, is to sell your stuff at a higher price, because that's how you make money. And the way to sell your stuff at a higher price and make more money means that you have to do soft commitment. You have to commit yourself to higher price, which, as I said, is harder to do than committing yourself to lower price. So that's the summary. And we are nearing the end of the lecture. We're nearing the end of the lecture. Let me see if there is anything worth repeating. Yes, there are a couple of things worth repeating. So what we've learned today, we've learned about strategic commitment, and it really changes the fortunes of the firms that engage in it. It has to be credible. The way to make it credible is to engage yourself in an action that you cannot pull out from, right? Just cheap talk doesn't help. You have to build a factory. That's how you commit to producing more output. It's harder to commit to selling things at a higher price, so that you need to think more about how to do it. But in the Cournot world, it's very easy. Okay. Of course, it's expensive. Now, another important thing we learned today is that strategic commitment works best when it's done when this commitment is made first. So, hence the notion of the first mover advantage. You have to the strategic commitment will be helpful if you make this commitment first. The worst thing that can happen to you if you both simultaneously make the strategic commitment, then you're going to overproduce, right? But if there is a sequence, if you try to establish yourself first in the market and create capacity to flood the market and effectively deter the entrance, that's the place where you want to be. So that's the notion of the first mover advantage, and the Stackelberg model that demonstrates this advantage, and the algebra of the Stackelberg model, which will be helpful for solving that problematic tutorial question, was also part of today's lecture. Yeah, that's basically it. And now there's a room for questions and comments. Are there any? No? Then thanks and see you in 2 weeks.